All right, so should we jump into the next one?
Yes, let's do it.
We're doing it.
We're doing it.
Fantastic.
Excellent.
Okay, great. Next one, we'll do, why don't we do key value stores? Because that's what it says on the slide.
That is next.
Okay.
Excellent. So key value store.
So why don't we just set the stage of where we are in the modules?
Yeah.
So again, we have lots of modules. We've gone through, if you've been watching the other ones, we've seen the overall data landscape and we've talked about relational databases. Now we'll jump into this thing called a key value store.
Okay, cool. Let's go and have a look. And a key value store is not where locksmiths go and buy keys, right?
No.
Okay.
Well, maybe they do go to the key store.
Well, maybe they do go to the key store.
There could be value in that.
All right. But it's generally not where locksmiths go shopping.
Okay. So today, with key stores, coming up after this slide, we'll talk about what this thing is, and we now know it's not a place for locksmiths. We'll talk about maybe why you want to use one, why maybe you don't. We'll talk about the options in Azure. Again, we'll talk about our services. We'll talk about IaaS, where you can spin up a VM and do what you want. And we'll do two quick demos. One, we'll spin up this thing called a Redis cache, and then we'll take a look at something called table storage.
Excellent. So, David, what is a key value store? If it's not a place for locksmiths to go shopping, what is it?
You have a dictionary? Obviously, because you're looking up big words like relational calculus.
I had to go and remind myself what calculus meant during the break. I was like, oh, my word.
Yeah, okay. Anyway. Think about a dictionary.
Okay.
Right? So in a dictionary, you look up a term and you get a definition.
Oh, no, never mind. Carry on.
Really?
Yeah. So dictionary, all right? So you look up, you have some kind of a key that you go and you find in the dictionary, right? And then you get the meaning of that word, right? So
right.
In a dictionary, the word is the keyword. Okay, so
now, if you think about the physical dictionary book, right? Well, let's forget about what we have online. Think about the book, and I know when I was a kid, maybe were you born yet? I don't know.
I don't know.
When you flip through,
my mom told me there's these things called paper dictionaries. Right. I just go to Bing and go define word, and it tells me what it is. Yeah.
So if you took a look at those, you'd flip through and you look at the edge binding, and yeah, there'd be little tabs for the letters of the alphabet, which let you jump in and you'd search for the letter and you search for the term, you'd find it. And typically, you weren't searching for words in the definition.
No, so I would never go and kind of do the TV game show version where I would go look up the description of something to find out what the key was.
Right, and you wouldn't look up the word like Bing just to see what it brought you back. Right?
Cool.
Okay, so anyway, it's a dictionary. You're looking up words, you're getting definitions, right? So basically you have a key and that key returns a value.
Which is largely opaque to me, right? It's just...
Right, so if we think about, again, the paper dictionary, when we look up the key, it's a word, a term, the value is one big opaque blob.
Okay.
It's a paragraph, it's a sentence, it's a description of the term.
Examples of how to use the word or whatever.
Yeah. Right. It's not returned in little chunks of terms and separate things, right?
Cool.
So that's the idea of key value pair.
Okay. Sounds simple.
Right.
And I think I certainly grok, even though I might not have used the dictionary, but I certainly grok the concept of what it is. Mm-hmm. So, why would I use a key value store? Where are they optimal?
So, again, great for discrete lookups. Even with this book we used to have before the advent of computers, and we have to call our parents over and say, how do I use this thing with paper and tabs? And, very quick, it could be 1,000 pages in this giant unabridged dictionary, and you could still get to the term you wanted in a matter of seconds. Well, that's the idea of a key store in database terms. Okay. So if you know a specific key, let's say it's a user ID or it's a GUID, a unique identifier to something, maybe...
Well, so device ID, if you've got connected devices and it's a device ID and every device has got a specific ID or whatever.
Right, and you want to look up some type of value about it.
Social security number or whatever.
Right, the idea is these things are built for speed.
Okay.
If you know what you're looking for, you give it the key, you get the value back really fast.
Okay.
Now, If you know the key, that's a really good thing. If you
don't know the key, then you're in a bit of trouble.
You don't always know the key.
Yeah, okay.
Sometimes you do. Sometimes you're searching for other attributes. So we'll think about that problem in a moment.
Okay.
And certainly if you're querying only by key, so if it's a game and we're always querying by the
player ID,
the player ID, or the maybe a combination of the player ID and the game
I'm not trying to find all players that are currently online, or all players that had a score higher than 1,000, or all players that logged on between this date and that date with a score higher than 1,000 that got shot a billion times before I even spawned.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting challenge, right? So if we think about a key store, and we look at things like, we have some type of key and some type of value.
What could that value be? I mean, that value can be almost anything, right?
Yeah, it can be really anything, but this key is where you're searching.
Okay.
What happens in the value space, we have to pretend we can't look in there.
Okay.
I mean, I guess we could with some effort, but
then I'd have to go to like every record and kind of go and inspect its value, right?
Right, so imagine you can't see in there. How are you going to get to your data? So again, if it's a game ID, great. If it's a game ID combined with a player ID and some type of compound key, if the key store supports such a thing, fantastic. Very quick to look it up, and we end up with the data we need. And then once that data comes back, we're free to do with it as we please.
Okay.
We can decipher the data, deserialize it, turn it into an object. It really doesn't matter. We can do whatever we want.
Cool. Okay. So if those are the use cases where a table is optimal, where is it not so optimal in a key value store? When should I not be using a key value store?
Yeah. So one thing we were just talking about, the value. What happens if you need to look in that value? You were talking about game scores.
Yeah.
Maybe it's inventory. Give me all players that have, I don't know, an axe or sword in their inventory. Okay.
Potion X or whatever. Yeah.
Right. Or an axe and potion.
Okay.
Or a particular type of potion.
Or a potion that he's never used, but with an axe that he has used. There we're getting to some really kind of complicated kind of queries.
Right. So when you're dealing with that level of query, how's this key store going to work for you? I think maybe it's a little bit of a challenge.
Yeah. Okay. I can certainly see that you could potentially go to every record and kind of retrieve it, look at its value, then look at the next one's value, and you could pull out some of that data from its value. But surely that's not very efficient, right?
Right.
So that's when we kind of want to start hedging away from potentially a key value store.
Right. So there's a very specific use case for it, and for what it's good at, it's phenomenal at.
Yeah, right? I mean, you can't get anything better than using a key value store for what it's meant as.
And
a dictionary lookup on a single key to look up a value, key value stores outperform anything.
Yeah, so going back to the last session, if you watched it or you go back and watch it later, relational databases, they really have a big engine behind all this data for you to query. The key value type of database doesn't really have that same engine, but it's much more efficient with just this discrete.
I can build these tables in SQL that are effectively key value stores, right?
Right.
I mean, I could do it, but I'm paying a lot of money for a very sophisticated engine that's capable of doing incredibly complicated kind of queries and transactions and joins and all of these kinds of things, and I don't necessarily need it. It would be like kind of going out and buying a McLaren supercar to go pick up the bread and milk from the dairy, right? Whereas I could kind of get away with getting the bread and milk in something much, much cheaper that's actually really efficient at getting the bread and milk, called my bread and milk delivery man or Amazon Fresh or whatever the case may be.
Although that would be cool, picking up
picking up bread and milk in a Ferrari could be kind of cool. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Just because I have a Ferrari, I can do it. All right.
Yeah. How come you never take me for a drive to pick up milk in your Ferrari?
We'll go during the break.
Fantastic. Can we be back on time? Oh well,
my
Ferrari, of course.
Absolutely. Yeah. All right. Okay. So we've kind of had a look at what is a key value store. We've had a look at we've been talking about some of the things that they're really, really good at doing. We've mentioned some of the things they're not so good at doing. So what are our options, David, in terms of doing this on Azure?
Okay. Yeah. Well, we're back to the pattern of talking about things as a service and things that you can install and run on your own. So as a service, Azure as a cloud platform has storage. It's durable storage. We take care of all this data replication and making three copies of your data, right? All those things to harden your data. So we have something called table storage. Okay. And it is a key value store, exactly like what we talked about. You look things up by key, you get the value. Mm-hmm. It is scalable. The scale units change every few months or a year. Every time I look at it, it's a little different. Now I think—
And the price is super cheap.
It's up to like 500 terabytes now.
But I think we're down to kind of like a couple of cents, like, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, 7 cents per gigabyte that you store or something like that.
It goes down even lower. You have your choice, and we'll take a look at that in a minute, of different options for your—
Geo-redundant and local redundant and not redundant at all and that kind of stuff.
Right.
But I mean, we're talking like super cents mm-hmm. per gigabyte, right?
Yep.
I mean, if I was to do the same thing in Azure SQL Database that we looked at, you know, and I was to create a table in Azure SQL Database, and all that table did was store key values, well, the cheapest Azure database that I've got is $5 a month for a 2 gig database. You know, so now we're talking $2.50 per gigabyte per month, whereas I'm storing 7 cents per gigabyte per month. Yeah. So this comes back to my Ferrari analogy. Sure, I can use SQL to do this, but if the only thing I'm using in SQL is this one kind of table with a key value pair, mm-hmm. why should I be paying $5 a month per gig to do this when I can do it for 7 cents a gig?
Right, so you're paying for the engine, and if you're not going to use the
engine— I'm not going to use the engine, right. I should buy a— pay for a small an engine that's optimized for that workload, right?
Right, maybe the little engine that could.
Well, not that table storage is a little engine. I mean, it's a massive engine, but it's designed for one very specific job, right?
Right.
Okay.
So we also have, for folks using caching, we have something called Redis, mm-hmm. and this is available as a service.
And a cache is a really good option as a key value store, right? Because you're generally storing something in a cache, some kind of value, and you're retrieving it from the cache by its value.
Okay. So that might be useful in something like a shopping site, maybe storing what's in your shopping cart.
ASP.NET session.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah.
What's in the shopping cart while I'm browsing, or if you're building those kind of breadcrumb trails on a website, you know, where you visited, what you mm-hmm. viewed, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yep.
Okay.
Now, from an infrastructure standpoint, you have many more options. Again, there's Redis as a virtual machine, but now you could set it up to be optionally durable, because today's Redis service, I don't think, offers durability.
Because it's designed to be a cache. It's not designed to be a database service. So it's designed to be a cache, and therefore they've switched the durability option in Redis off.
Yep.
But if you want to use Redis and you want it durable, well, then you can spin up a VM and install Redis on it and make it durable.
Okay. So we have React, we have Memcache, and there's pretty much anything else you want to install.
So the same as relational on VMs. Mm-hmm. You know, if you can run it on a Windows box or a Linux box today, you can run it in Azure, probably.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Great. So let's take a quick look, then, mm-hmm. In a demo of provisioning an Azure Redis cache. Okay?
Okay.
Cool. So let me do that. I'm going to jump into the portal again, and I'm going to go into Add New, which is where we always start when we want to create a new service. And if you scroll down here, you'll see Redis cache. But again, if it's not there, you can go under everything, find it under data, but go to Redis cache. And here I would kind of put in the name. And this, like all services, they have to be a unique name, right? So I couldn't do something, you probably find someone else has already taken test. Yeah, someone else has already taken test. And that's because of this DNS name that resolves into a name. So it's got to be unique around the world. So I'm going to do something called polyglot demo, okay? And that one is unique. There aren't anybody else doing polyglot demos with a Redis cache. Surprising. I can choose my pricing tier. So again, I've got different kinds of pricing tiers. I can start off with a standard 1 gig kind of cache. I can have a 250 meg cache if I wanted. I can have, you know, right up to a 53 gig cache if I really wanted a 53 gig cache. All right. And it gives you the estimated price per month.
And also, as you scroll through those options, some of them have replication, some of them don't, some of them have SLA,
some of them have SSL, some of them don't, you know, all that kind of stuff. So pick the one that kind of works, or they actually all have SSL. Anyway, so I'm going to pick a small Redis cache, you know, one replica, so it's not going to be highly available, it's got some replication, it's got an SLA, all that kind of stuff. Resource group, pick your subscription, pick your location. So that's the one I want. Pick your location. I'm going to put... So if you pick your location, I'm going to put this one in the West US. And I'm going to create, and I'll put it to my start board. So now you'll see this one will go ahead, and once it's... It takes a couple of minutes because we're spinning up some infrastructure in the background for you. Mm-hmm. But once it's up, you'll end up with a tile that looks like this that you can go into it, and you can actually see... some information about your Redis cache. You can configure alerts. You can do a bunch of things over here. You can go to your settings. You can get your access keys. And this is what you'll need over here for when you actually want to get start using it. And you can see what your ports are, you know, what your maximum memory policy is and all that kind of stuff. You can do users, roles, properties, all that kind of stuff. There's your host name, which you'll need as well. And there's the SSL port when you actually want to connect to it. And there's the actual key that you will need. So once you've got that, all you do in your application is you use the pull in the NuGet package for Redis cache, and you start coding against it. And that's it. In a couple of clicks, I've created a highly available Redis cache that I can just start using in my application. And Redis is really cool. You know, simple key value store, highly performant. You know, this one's distributed. So if you're running a web application that has multiple nodes, you know, I would definitely say spin up one of these things, you know, put your session or that kind of stuff in this cache, and it'll be available from every node in your web application.
Fantastic.
So that's that, yeah.
Great. So why don't we take a look at one other type? So we'll take a quick look at Azure Table Storage.
Yeah.
So let's go back to the portal. Now, Table Storage is part of our storage family. Mm-hmm. So when you spin up...
blobs and queues, yeah.
Right. When you spin up a storage account, you get more than just table storage. Now, in this case, it's not available on my list here. But if we just scroll down a little bit, we should see, let's see, where did storage go? We'll just search for it here. So here is our Microsoft storage options,
yep.
Right?
Cool.
And so when we set up...
Polyglot demo, yeah. Again, it's got to be a unique DNS name.
Yep. So what's interesting about storage, we were talking a little bit about some options for replication. When you build out your storage account, mm-hmm. we have a couple of choices. One is locally redundant. Now, this is still durable storage.
It just saves multiple copies within that data center.
Right, so it's within one region. So... if Godzilla comes walking through the town and steps on the region and, you know, steps on a data center and destroys all three copies, well, we have a little bit of a problem.
That's what the next one's for, right?
Right. Geo-redundant. So now we have another region at least 400 miles out, I believe.
Yep.
So we've paired up all of our...
West Azure... US, East US, North yep. and South.
Yep. Amsterdam.
Hong Kong, Singapore, Amsterdam, Dublin.
Yep. And then the two in Japan.
The two Australian ones.
Two in China. I think...
Brazil's paired with South.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
So maybe that's not good enough because if one of those regions fail, Azure takes over and decides when we're going to fail to a secondary.
Mm-hmm.
Like if there's a real disaster. Mm-hmm. Then we can opt for... read access.
Okay.
So now we can make the decision to
I can even
reach
then
out.
Distribute my reads across the globe depending on where you are, right? So I can give you a regional read. If you're in Australia, I can send you to an Australia replica so you can get a quicker read. You don't have to come all the way back to you know, somewhere else.
Right.
Okay.
So that's really all there is to it.
Cool.
And then you would choose your location.
Choose the location. That's the primary. That'll be the master, right? That's where the writes go.
That's right. Yep, you choose whatever account you want, and you know, off and running.
Bang.
So,
cool. Okay.
Once you have a storage account, it's very easy to take a look. Again, you know, you mentioned something before about keys. So, the way storage works, it turns out all access to Azure Storage is through a REST API. So, in non-programmer speak, that's just a way of speaking over the internet. Very simple type of...
Most of our services are, right?
So, right.
Yeah, okay.
Yep, and storage is no exception to that.
Cool.
And in order to gain access to the storage account, you would have
to
know...
You need an endpoint and you need a key.
Right, okay. You need to know one of these keys.
Cool, okay.
So if we wanted to take a look at what some of this data might look like in a table, mm-hmm. let's go over to Visual Studio go? There it is. All right, so let's start off by, let me just close these out. We'll get right back to them. But one thing that's nice about Visual Studio is it has some built-in viewers and explorers.
Cool.
So I'm taking advantage. I installed the Azure tools.
Yep.
So I'm taking advantage of them.
So if you don't have those, go and install the Azure SDK.
Yeah, azure.com. There's download, and you can install it right to Visual Studio. There are also some third-party tools.
Oh, right?
This is certainly not required.
Yeah.
But I went ahead and added a storage account. So we'll take a look at a shopping site later today in our later demo.
Yep.
But I wanted to show what a table might look like. So I have an example of a task database.
Okay.
And we've all dealt with tracking tasks. And in this particular case, all I'm doing is tracking things. You know, it's a to-do list.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes there are, there are tasks that are complete. There are tasks mm-hmm. that aren't. In this particular example,
this looks very much like a flat kind of table that I would see in a relational database, though, that has columns and it has rows.
Right.
What?
The,
yeah.
So the issue here,
that
where it works really well,
okay.
is if let's say that the row key was a user
yep.
ID,
okay.
or a partition key was a user ID.
Mm-hmm.
Very easy to pull up all the tasks.
Okay.
So we could actually, instead of P1, maybe that's my user ID.
Okay.
P2 could be you, so we have...
That'll tell Azure Storage how to partition your data and
right.
what data to keep together on a node versus spreading it out over thousands of other nodes.
Exactly. So we use a combination of partition and row to uniquely identify data.
Okay.
Now, I could say for this partition, give me all rows. So for P1, give me all rows. So that's David's.
But this still looks like a very relational model, right? Because I could create an ID and a primary key and all of that kind of stuff in SQL, and I could get, hey, give me all rows where primary key equals P1, right?
Right, but what about if we want to know where things are complete or not complete?
Okay.
So that's I'll draw that in red because that's not exactly a great use case. If I wanted to say where complete equals true,
but do all my tables in table storage or in my key value store like this is, do they all have to be the same schema? Do all records have to follow the same schema?
No, it turns out that one over here has an e-tag, right? It's the only one with an e-tag.
Okay.
So no, this is variable schema per, we don't even want to call them rows, they're entities.
They're entities, okay.
Because the columns aren't even related.
Okay, yeah.
I mean, they happen in this case to have the same columns, but that doesn't mean they have to.
It might just be the visualizer, they've drawn it like this so that you can actually visualize it, right?
Right.
Okay.
So
it's an actual entity.
Yep, and again, we have to treat as opaque as
possible.
No, this
all
stuff.
That stuff is
right.
not there.
Whatever's in that green box, we really have to
we
say.
Can't see it.
Yeah.
The only stuff that we really want to know about is the stuff that's in that blue box, right?
Now, we actually can see it, but we would have to do a scan.
We'd have to go and scan through every row in the
right.
table.
We can easily get to all the P1s.
Yep.
But where complete equals true, we would have to bring back and take a look at
every row, one by one by one. Okay.
Yeah. It's a little painful.
All right. Cool.
Okay. So I have one other example. You were talking about some variable mm-hmm. data. So this is an imaginary game. This game doesn't actually exist. But if it did, it's really cool because it uses JSON.
Okay.
And JSON's cool.
Yeah.
So the idea is, again, our partition key lets us look up the player. The row key maybe looks up a type of data.
So then you've got an inventory or a status. Or
right. Now, inventory, map, and status. I noticed that Ryan down here does not have inventory, because it's not required by the game. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Someone stole all my inventory.
Right. But what?
It's probably you. But yeah. Okay.
What's interesting is you do have extra.
Oh, extra.
Right.
Cool.
So there's this extra column. Not everybody has extras.
Okay.
Right.
Oh.
So again, variable schema.
Variable schema. JSON in the object.
Yeah, so I'm storing JSON
but
in the object.
But again, that's opaque, right? I shouldn't be kind of trying to query on values in that JSON.
No, but when it comes back, if I say I want all of my player data, just bring
then
it back
to
me.
You can map it into an object
and
serialize it.
Trivial at that point.
But I can't go and say, well, give me all your player data where strength equals 17, for instance.
You would have to really dig into those.
But this adds some nice flexibility because now we've got kind of variable schema, we've got really quick access by its partition key. So I can start seeing the difference here between this table and a table in a relational database, right?
Right.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, makes sense, absolutely.
All right.
So to wrap up then on this module, you know, as a summary, what have we spoken about?
Yeah, so let's go back, pop these up. Whoops. All right, so we talked about what a key value store is, and certainly what a key store is not.
So while locksmiths could use a key store, they're not exclusive to locksmiths.
We're going to run that joke right
in the ground. I'm going to use that one as long as we can, yeah.
Okay, we talked about optimal cases for a key value store where we treat the data as opaque. We talked about the non-optimal case where we need to peek into that data.
Yep.
Okay. We did a little demo of how to provision a Redis cache, which is easily then used in your application.
Yep.
And we took a look at Azure Table Storage and some of the options for durability and geo-replication and some options there.
Okay. Well, that's pretty much a wrap for the module of key value stores. So that's great. We'll take another break and we will be back on air after the break.